Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland. Hello, and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. This week, we are quite remarkably on episode 43, which for a series of six is really poor maths. Anyway, today we've got a cracker for you. We are introducing the new book by Carolyn Jess Cook, who is known on this book as C.J. Cook, and her book's called The Lighthouse Witches. It comes out, I think by the time you hear this, it'll be out for a couple of days. It's definitely worth reading, but you could listen to it too, I'm sure, on Audible or equivalent. Carolyn's a marvellous writer, has written several novels already, teaches creative writing at the University of Glasgow, so really knows her stuff. We had a really nice chat with her, so definitely listen to that and then check out the book. If you're into witches, if you're into families, if you're into witches and families, this is definitely the book for you. So we'll be talking about that afterwards. But before we go on to today's guest, Claire, I was just wondering, is there any news you'd like to talk about?
I mean, imagine my surprise at you asking that question, Zoe. Well, I suppose our first bit of news is we have written back to the Parliamentary Committee as they asked us. The Parliamentary Committee asked both us and the Scottish Government to write back to them after posing a number of questions about the issue of a pardon. So we've written back to them explaining that we would be more than happy to come and give evidence and speak to them, and also identifying how we would like to go about a pardon, which is by legislative form. And I think we spoke about that on the last occasion. So that letter is back now in with them, and we're now waiting to hear back from them or to hear it come back up. So as soon as we hear it's back before the committee, we'll let everyone know what's happening with it then.
It's really great, actually, to see the progress of the campaign, because we've been working on it for such a long time. So to see it getting towards, hopefully, a more positive end result is really exciting. So basically, watch this space, Claire.
Absolutely. Can't wait for that. And we've also got some positive update on statue news as well.
Oh, yeah.
We saw this week that a woman, her full name is Rachel Elizabeth Campbell, but known as Betty Campbell, a woman who was born in 1934 to a Jamaican father and Welsh Barbadian mother, and became a teacher in 1963 and became a head teacher in a school in Wales. What happened was there was a decision taken to honour her for all the work that she'd done in the community with children, and they put up a statue to her which marked what's described as the first of its kind, which honours a non-fictional woman in a public space in Wales. So I thought that was fantastic that there had been a decision taken to honour a woman of colour, non-fictional, in a public space in Wales. I hope it's only the first of many statues of its kind.
Me too, because it's so important, as we've said so many times, we need to see ourselves represented. You know, if we're going to have statues, we need to make sure that at least half the statues are women, I think, so that the half of the population that's female can see themselves there. I think it's really important. And I love the fact that it's a teacher, but also, you know, because I am a teacher, but also because it's nice to see somebody who's clearly had such a positive impact on lots of children, you know, who have grown up to have fond memories, and it's had a big impact on their lives. I think it's a really nice positive thing that it's not a marker of war. It's a marker of somebody that has done a fantastic thing with their life, that they lived a really worthwhile, positive life.
That's why I think so many women aren't shown in their community for the things that they've done, because we tend to just put down markers for people who have been killed in wars. And remember, even Sarah Sheridan told us right back at one of our earliest podcasts that in fact the names of women weren't put on plaques in relation to the war dead. So even those who had actually died in the war, their names weren't mentioned. I think I'm getting a wee bit obsessed though. So yeah, I went down to London and I went down to Spitalfields, and there's a really, really nice art installation on, which is about elephants, and there's elephants all over Spitalfields talking about the individual elephants, and it really was lovely and it was beautiful. But in my head I was going, yeah, they're elephants, but it would be really, really good if we could do this with statues of women, even if it's a temporary thing, just putting up statues of women all around public spaces and seeing what they did, how they contributed to their community, how they made it better.
That'd be cool. You know, there are statues of women going up in some places around the world, Claire, and I'd just like to draw your and our listeners' attention to a remarkable statue that's just gone up in Italy. I don't know if any of our listeners have seen this. I would definitely recommend Googling for this. So I would just put in the search bar something like statue scantily clad woman Italy, and that should bring up some results for you. Might also bring up other things too, so be careful. But a statue has just been unveiled in Italy of a female field worker. Now, the photograph in the article that I'm looking at is a picture of the statue from behind. So it's bronze. It's a lady wearing like a kind of, I don't know what you would call that, what that style is. It's like an off-the-shoulder kind of top. And she's looking back suggestively over her shoulder in a kind of a come-hither sort of a look. And her arms hanging down for a side, her hands open. And just sort of just behind her forearm is really a remarkable pair of buttocks that are sculpted fantastically to show that the fabric of her dress is very much clinging to those buttocks. So you really do get a very good view of her rear end. And the statue is of a woman who's featured in a poem. So the poem was called, please excuse my terrible pronunciation, because just because I've got an Italian surname does not mean I speak Italian, but it's La Spiolatrice di Sapri, The Gleaner of Sapri, by Luigi Mercantini, which tells the story of Carlo Pisacane, an early socialist thinker who led a failed attempt to liberate the Bourbon Kingdom of Naples. Okay, so this woman was involved in the poem in some way, and is absolutely horrifying. And then it was sculpted by a sculptor called Emanuele Stefano. And Italians have been quite divided on this, I think. The unveiling itself was attended by almost entirely just men. And there has been an outcry from some Italians. So an Italian politician called Laura Boldrini called the statue an offence to women and the history it should celebrate, asking on Twitter, how can institutions accept the representation of a woman as a sexualized body? And there's been other female politicians that have asked for the statue to be removed, saying things like, once again, we have to suffer the humiliation of seeing ourselves represented in the form of a sexualized body, devoid of soul and without any connection with the social and political issues of the stories. Now, you know, like, it's kind of funny because it's a ridiculous statue. It's kind of a soft, porny kind of a statue. But at the same time, it's obviously not funny at all, because this is a representation of women. And just imagine that you're a kid in the place that that's been unveiled. Imagine you're a little girl and that's what you see, and you just think, oh, right, okay, so what am I here for? Just to be hot. And, you know, it's just really, really horrifying.
It's laughable. I mean, yeah. You look at it and you think, what did someone stand back after they put that up and thought, this is going to do it. This is really going to honour those people that were working in those fields. That is how they would want to be remembered.
I think it's really funny that the sculptor Stefano, it's no coincidence, I don't think, that the first syllable of his name is Stefano there, defended the work, saying on Facebook that if he had been afforded his full creative liberty, the statue would have been completely naked, get this, simply because I am a lover of the human body. I don't Sorry to make the puke sound. I'm really sorry, because I'm really offended when people do that. But that is horrifying. And Antonio Gentile, the mayor of Sapri, said in a statement that throughout the review process, nobody had criticised or distorted the works of art. I mean, maybe no man had criticised.
You've got to wonder who they were showing this to.
And in what sort of setting? Anyway, we've got work to do, Claire, and I'm glad that we are working hard to make sure that there is some sensible, thoughtful, lovely, well, maybe lovely is the wrong word, provocative, but not like this, that's the wrong word also.
Even challenging.
Challenging is good. Yeah, it should be something that makes people connect with the story of the witches in Scotland and lets them understand what's there. Also shows, you know, the horror of what happened, you know. So, yeah, I think we've got a long way to go as humans. And this is just more of an example about that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's like even when the idea is right that they want to show about women that were working there and working in the field, it still just goes horribly wrong.
Jeez, oh. Yep, so we'll just swiftly move on from that, I think. Not so swift, but anyway. Claire, do we have some women to remember today?
We do have women to remember today. And the way I chose these people was to look at people that were near the seaside, basically, near the sea, because the book that we're going to talk about is based near the sea. And I thought I would look for somewhere. Now, the most obvious one is, of course, North Berwick. And I looked at the interactive map, which is done by University of Edinburgh, which links in with this survey of Scottish witchcraft. And I decided to go for a wee place near Musselburgh called Fisher Row, because I saw the names of a number of women there. So we have some, not really much information, except until we get to the last women's trial, but here goes. We have, first of all, Jonet Douglas. She was a woman who lived in the parish of Inveresk. She was married. We know that her husband was called Thomas Patterson, and she was detained in Canongate in Edinburgh before coming to trial. We know that her trial was on the 1st of June, 1661, that date being the year when there was a huge wave of trials. And from the information that we can glean, we see that she had no less than 9 commissioners and 3 investigators, all trying to work out whether or not she was a witch, and of course, all of them men. Sadly, we don't know the outcome of her case. So that is Jonet Douglas.
So the second person is Janet Hardy. Her parish was also Inveresk. She was married, and her socioeconomic status is described as middling, which is quite interesting. It was noted that her husband, Robert Clark, was a skipper. We know that she was accused and tried on the 9th of June, 1629, but the outcome is not recorded.
And finally, the third woman is Gailis Harley. The investigation date for her is noted as the 8th of September, 1679, so quite late on. She was married to a William Patterson. Her parish was also Inveresk, and she lived in Fisher Row. She was accused of witchcraft, sorcery, necromancy, and the renunciation of baptism and giving themselves over to the devil, body and soul. And that was kind of a common phraseology that was used, the sort of wording that you find up coming over and time again. So that is, if there was in its day a kind of cut and paste, that appears to be what it was. In her case, there was an expert witch pricker called David Cowan. She did go to trial, but there's no information on whether or not she was executed. Her case was linked to the trial of 3 other women in the same area, and all being investigated by David Cowan, the witch pricker, too. Their names are Bessie Ramsay, Marion Robertson, and Catherine Smith. Their trial date was on the same day as Gailis Harvey too. David Cowan we know a wee bit more about. David Cowan was a local expert pricker from Preston Pans, so nearby from where they lived. And unfortunately, he was clearly so keen in his work that he didn't just do it officially when he was asked to, because in 1687, he was accused of, quote, imprisoning and pricking an accused witch in 1678, and also involved in 1679. Later, he was taken prisoner himself. So what has happened is he has been working unofficially at looking at bodies, mostly no doubt of women, and carrying out these hocus-pocus investigations on whether or not if he pricked them or if he examined their body and found devil's marks. So what happened to him when he was found to have been doing this unofficially? Was he thrown in jail? Was he given a fine? No, he was just ordered not to search for marks again without license from the Privy Council. So basically he was told, you're only allowed to do this when the Privy Council allows you to do so. So pretty much so you have this self-appointed witch pricker checking women and men for the devil's mark. Not great.
No, it's great. You just set yourself up to do it. It's just Just nuts.
Absolutely. A well paid job that we know about as well. It was something that made people a lot of money. In any event, he unfortunately was involved in the trial of Gaylis Hardy, Bessie Ramsey, Marion Robertson and Catherine Smith. So we remember them along with Janet Hardy and Jonet Douglas, women who were accused of being witches when of course they weren't.
So Carolyn Jess Cook, who is known on her recent books as C.J. Cook, is the author of the book that we're talking about today, and it's called The Lighthouse Witches. Carolyn wrote her first book when she was 7, and a few decades later, her work has now been published in 23 languages, has won loads of awards, and has been optioned for both film and TV. She writes about motherhood, climate change, and trauma, and her fiction is often classed as gothic or psychological suspense. Her previous work includes the novels The Boy Who Could See Demons, and she has also written a book called The Nesting, which has been out for a little while. I think it's just come out maybe in paperback. And her new novel, The Lighthouse Witches, just came out a couple of days ago. And that's what we're talking about today because, of course, it's, as the title suggests, it's about witches. So please welcome to our podcast, C.J. Cook.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we're delighted to have you on because you have just released, it's just gone out into the wild, your latest novel, The Lighthouse Witches, which we know our listeners are going to absolutely love. It's right up their street, definitely, right up our street as well.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic setting, delves into lots of different aspects about what happened in the past, what happens now, small towns, weird stories, the way they get passed on. Is such a fab story. So really, really great to read it. I'm wondering, first of all, what is it that brought you to write a book with this sort of theme?
So I've been working at the University of Glasgow since 2014. I commuted for quite a while. We were based in Whitley Bay, where there is a lighthouse, and I can talk about that later. But gradually, as I spent time in Scotland, I remember hearing about Scottish witch trials, and that struck me because I had never thought that there were witch trials outside of, I knew there were some in England and obviously Salem, but it had never occurred to me that they had sort of been in multiple places. And in drips and drabs, I just sort of stumbled across information that really intrigued me. And when we finally relocated here in 2019, well, I learned that our new home was 20 minutes away from a site where 12 people had been executed for witchcraft. And that was really striking to me, that such a, you know, that's really quite serious and horrendous and awful. And yet it seemed very low key. So the information was online, but the visibility of it, there was no kind of, I mean, there's a small marker of the site, but it just seemed really striking to me that this is a very significant piece of history. And I came across it by accident. And it was very poignant too, because two of the accused were little boys. Now, there's some research that says that they managed to avoid execution. And then there's research that says that they did not, that they were executed. But it's terrible that these are young, young children, you know, the age of my son at the time, one of them was 11, and they lived in an estate close to our new home, just outside Glasgow. So all of this very troubling, dark history just seemed super low key. And the more I researched it, the more I would keep coming across sites that when I would go to the site, there was just nothing there. So for instance, Gourock, which is about 30 minutes from me, I actually went there to write part of this book. And this was when I was really developing that witch element, because I have to say at first, I was very nervous. It took me quite a long time to write this book. I was very nervous about how I was going to make the two elements, the modern day story and the story in 1662, speak to each other in a convincing way. And when I was in Gourock, I thought, I'll see if there's any sort of witch sites. And there was the Kempock stone just behind the high street, where it's a stone that was placed there by the Druids, apparently, and it has all this kind of fortune narrative around it that it can bring good luck, and people would leave little offerings. And a woman named Mary Lamont was 18 years old when she was accused of plotting with Satan to chuck the stone into the sea to sink all the ships. And when I went to the site, there is a plaque there, but there's no mention of this kind of part of history. And then I looked online and saw that Mary was executed on the grounds of a kirk in Inverkip. I went to the kirk, nothing about Mary. And so this kind of repeated, you know, astonishment at how much silence there is around this history, I think that emboldened me to really tease that story out and make sure it wasn't just a small element of the book. So that's how I discovered the history of Scotland's witches.
It's really interesting. I like the way that you've sort of sewn together the modern day setting and the based on truth in the 1600s. I really like that. I enjoyed that. And I think it's interesting as well that your central characters are women and girls. I enjoyed that because you do have a think about, you know, what it would have been like to be vulnerable in a small place in a dangerous time. Now we get into the dangerous bit where you're talking about a book and you don't want to give away anything that actually happens in it. So I'm sort of thinking here, what can I say that's not going to be a spoiler? Because there's so much, the book's really, it's complex with the way that it's worked out. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the book opens.
That's a good way in, isn't it? So the book is, I'll say where it's set. It's set on a fictional Scottish island called Lonehaven. I love islands. I'm sort of obsessed with islands, and they do make for a good setting for a mystery because you immediately have that sense that you can control quite a bit that goes on. And I'll talk about maybe the research where I went to various islands to just get a feel for them. And on that island, on Lonehaven, there is a lighthouse, which is derelict, and Liv is a single mother in her mid-30s who is an artist, and she's commissioned to come and paint a mural inside the lighthouse, which turns out to be a bit of a strange commission because the actual mural itself is just very perplexing and doesn't make sense and is a difficult job. And she brings with her three daughters, her three girls. Sapphire is 15, Luna is 9, and Clover is 7. And I suppose that's where I started with the book. I wanted to write about motherhood and the different stages, I guess, of motherhood, because I have a teenage daughter now, and I was interested in writing about that relationship between the sisters and the single mother and her own kind of, I guess, struggles in this new place. She's out of her comfort zone. She's never been to this part of Scotland. She's on an island with people who are a bit suspicious of her, and she's treated like an outsider, if you like. So that's the context, I guess, or the kicking off point of the story and what she discovers in terms of the things that are going on with the lighthouse and the owner of the lighthouse and the bothy that she's staying in are cause for concern.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, it's definitely cause for concern. Did you do a great deal of research into islands and island life and that side of things, lighthouses? Because they're all really important to the story.
Yeah, this book took a good couple of years to write. So there was a fair bit of research over that time. As I said, I lived on the coast of northeast England, and there's St. Mary's Lighthouse that was right near where we lived, which is really beautiful, a really striking tall lighthouse. And we would often go there. So I think over time that setting really struck me, and I would go in when I decided that I was going to, you know, use a lighthouse in this book. I did spend time in that lighthouse and read about the history of lighthouses, which I think, you know, indirectly sort of impacted the book. It was probably more on a practical level that research played in, because I had to understand how she would physically attempt to paint a mural inside a lighthouse. So all of that was quite important. But as you say, island life was something that I needed to understand a bit more. And helpfully, I got stranded on Arran. I went to Arran to spend some time to write, and the ferries got cancelled. And that was actually, it turned out very well, because I got that real flavour for what it is to just not have the ability to leave. So that was really useful. The other research that I did was in terms of Scottish folklore. I wanted to understand the myths and the narratives that sort of underpin the past. And then I also had this very serendipitous trip to Iceland, where I was invited to go and teach at the University of Iceland. And when I went to, I had a day off, and when I went to the National Museum, I came across these ancient spell books in the in a glass cabinet with all the, as you know, the diagrams and the magical staves. And that just blew my mind. I was able to sort of research the history of magic and really understand a lot more about the kind of society that we had back then, how people did believe in magic to a huge extent. It was just a given, and that continues in various parts of the world, even in the form of superstition. So a large part of the book is concerned with belief and the sort of stories that we tell ourselves. And of course, that's still relevant now.
Absolutely. That was something that stood out really, really strongly for me, was that you tell a story and that story is what you believe, and you just focus on that story, and it doesn't matter if other things come in the way of it. You just dismiss those other things and you stick with your narrative. And that held really, really true to me throughout the story. I saw immediate parallels with accusations of witchcraft and people being called witches. And once that stuck, anything they did to try and identify themselves not as witches just further proved they were witches. And I felt that was a really, really, a really strong narrative. I like what you say as well about the stuff in Iceland. And I'll remind the listeners that in episode 32, we speak to the curator of the Icelandic Museum of Witchcraft. And she talks in some detail about the way that witchcraft accusations didn't really take off there in the same way that they did here, because magic was all around them. It was just a part of their lives. They had that. So there wasn't that great fear associated with it when people were talking about spells or witches, something that unfortunately was very different from what we found here, and certainly island life as you found it in the book.
Yeah, and there was something I was listening to the last podcast as well. I think it was podcast 40. We have this great conversation about heresy and how we're still seeing that today. The more I researched the past and, you know, and tried to understand what life was like back then, the more I found my assumption that things were massively different sort of fading away. If anything, I found real parallels, and without spoiling a part of the book, you know, I guess that emboldened me again to push an idea I had for how I was going to bring things together plot-wise. But there was just so much dialogue between the distant past and now. It felt to me as if we could learn quite a bit from simply confronting and trying to unpick the reasons behind these executions, these accusations, the whole system of everything that underpinned the witch trials that enabled that. We could learn a lot, I think, by just studying it.
That's certainly why we want to particularly shine a light on it. It's to pardon these people and to focus on the fact that this happened to people that were perfectly rational people, that were people just like us. I'm talking about the people that were persecuting as well as the people that were witches. They were all just like us, but they lived in difficult times. They were looking for scapegoats. They had a narrative. They had a different, the outside of their world was different in that they had a different belief system. But within that belief system, it caused them to do terrible, terrible things in the name of good. That's what they thought they were doing. And that's why it's so scary, because in killing innocent women, they thought they were saving their society.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting with the parallel with the pandemic. You know, I think that one of the biggest fears then absolutely must have been illness, the fact that they didn't know what was wrong with people and they didn't know what to do generally. I mean, I know there were obviously some folk cures and that sort of thing, which is partly where the trouble stems from as well for some of the accused, obviously. But the fact that there's this kind of scary universe out there that could strike down a whole family, and that they're, you know, people would really be desperate to try and find an explanation for that, so they wouldn't feel as powerless. And you definitely go into that in the book, again, without giving anything away. I think that's really interesting, sort of looking at that and the way that people really wanted to explain terrible things. I mean, now at least we know the pandemic kind of works in a particular way, and there are particular things you can do to help your chances and so on, and try and stop it from being spread. And we don't view it as, well, most of us, I do read the odd person on Facebook where I think, oh, you've got a very interesting interpretation, but we generally don't think that it's some sort of spooky thing that has been visited upon us. You know, we can understand to an extent the science behind it. So I find that really interesting. Did you make up any of the folklore concepts in the book, or are they like real things that people really did believe in?
So in terms of how they use the magical staves, that's all based on research and fact.
Can you explain to listeners what that is?
Yes, I will. So when I went to Iceland and I learned about the spell books and the grimoires, which is a beautiful name.
It's grim, it's a memoir.
It sounds
all the things.
There's a sort of noir kind of sound as well in there. It's just a great name. And I had started writing the element of the book where there's a sort of jotter of someone's diary, and I decided to make that a grimoire as well. But a grimoire contains typically different diagrams, if you like, that you can etch onto the bottom of barrels, for instance, to prevent the water from being spoiled, for instance. There's different magical staves to assist with. There's a lot around fishing. So to enable a fair journey and a good catch and a safe return home, there's all these different staves that people would, I guess, paint onto objects or onto the skin. I think there's a love charm where you have to put it on, you have to draw it on your own breast, but you have to give yourself a nosebleed first and use the blood to paint it on your breast. And there's lots of magical
things. The most gothic thing I've ever heard.
Right. Yeah. I thought, gosh, it's not just a nice wee diagram then. You've got to actually really commit to this.
I think you're describing IKEA instruction packets now as grimoires, and they'll make me more interested in actually trying to get to grips with them, you know.
Yes,
if you get your grimoire right, if you follow your grimoire, you get this magical chest of drawers.
Yes, so that gave me a good appreciation as well around the sort of levels of superstition and the way people really believed in magic. And I think also I learned from one of your podcasts that the distinction between what we call white magic and black magic wasn't as clear cut. It was just magic. And then there seemed to be this kind of interpretation of certain types of magic that are crossing a line. But obviously there was much more of a, I guess, political agenda that seems to be directed towards women.
It was where they got their power from. That was what it was all about, I think. It was said that if women were getting power as witches, they couldn't possibly have got that power themselves. Obviously, they had to get it from somewhere else. And that somewhere else was the devil. That's how the narrative worked. But it's the getting your power for the devil and allowing the devil to work through you with witchcraft is what the problematic was. But if you didn't have anything to do with the devil, if you were a self-respecting charmer or something like that, then that was fine. But the difficulty was that the line between that is a narrow one. You know, how difficult would it be for someone to say, well, you did give me that charm, but it didn't work, and the opposite happened. Somebody, it was a charm for health, I got sick, or, you know, a family member got sick and then they died, and I think it was witchcraft.
Yeah.
That's where it became so difficult. But it's interesting, isn't it, that through the centuries, there's a pervasive idea that continues to this very day and is very popular about witchcraft, about modern day signs and symbols and how we interact with the world and what we can do to make our situation better when we interact with the world.
Yeah, I also find it very interesting that in the case I mentioned, the Paisley trials were, I think it was definitely 12 people who were executed, but there had originally been 30 accused. But the reason that it sort of whittled down to 12 was because the others bought their way out. So that to me was very interesting, that there's still obviously a socioeconomic factor here in who actually ended up paying the price. Well, they didn't pay any. I mean, you know, they were innocent, but, you know, you could be accused and then kind of pay your way.
That could certainly happen in some situations. There's also some situations where it didn't matter how much money people threw at it, they would still be killed. But it does show that, again, it's nothing changes. Is there corruption? Was there corruption then? Yes. You know,
yeah.
Are there corruptions in areas of the world now? Yes. It's the same. It's the same idea. If you've got money, you're definitely better off in the world.
I think fundamentally, the more kind of research that I did into this area, the more I was moved by the humanness. These were people, and the sort of details that you gather as you research tell so much. They bring a nuance to the story, because you can, and I think one of your other guests said this, that you can almost become desensitized or lost in the language of witch trials and executions and burnings. And there's a risk, I think, of just forgetting that these are just people. And, you know, when I, and again, I think it was one of your podcasts, you know, that one of the accused was actually in prison for 5 years. So this is not just being put into jail for a couple of nights. This was, I mean, what would that do to you as a person? So even if you don't end up being executed and you survive somehow that kind of imprisonment, and being imprisoned under suspicion of being a witch, you're not going to be treated like a modern day prisoner. You're, you know, your body's going to have deteriorated because of lack of nutrition. You, goodness knows what kind of torture and abuse you've suffered. And I also find that when you read the accusations made against people that they, or the things that they confess to, you can only imagine why they confess to such things, knowing what that confession will bring. It's a horrendous history to confront. And I suppose that's why the silence around it really astonished me and continues to astonish me.
Well, we're doing all we can, and you're certainly doing your bit, Carolyn, to promote the idea of us looking at our history and coming to terms with it. And I mean, I hope people reading the book, you're very, very generous in, you know, mentioning us and mentioning others in the book and in talking about these things. And I hope people who read the book are spurred on to do their own researches as well. That would be really, really great if it got them to thinking about, I wonder in our local area, what happened in the 17th century?
Because it's very relatable. I think what you do in the book is you create a situation where you think they were just people just kind of living their lives. And the thought that it was often, you know, mothers of small children, and the way that you've described it in the book, it really does bring it to life, the idea that this was just people just going about their business and it could have happened to anybody. It's really very startling. And I think fiction, you know, I would say this, but I think fiction in itself is kind of a magical thing, because it means you can read the facts over again and it's going to have an impact on you. But when you start to have a fictional character that you're going through what they're going through on the page, I think it makes it so much more real. Must have been hard work for you writing it from that point of view, because it's grim.
This book took, as I said, a lot longer than usual, because, well, I think structurally there's some things that I was trying that I thought, gosh, how am I going to pull this off, because it felt like I was mashing together too many different genres. But also trying to make sure that all of the characters, both in the modern day and in the past, were brought to life. And yes, writing some of the more traumatic scenes was very difficult. But as I said, I think I was just really spurred on. I mean, when I would come across names in the digital editions or the digital archive of the Highland Papers, and you would just have names of people. So sometimes we are able to get a bit of a picture around what happened to someone like Mary Lamont in Gourock. But, you know, there's some people who are just mentioned by name and they're accused and then they're executed. And that moved me, that real silence there. I just thought, you know, we have no idea who these people were, and they met with such a troubling and just terrible fate. And what really moved me as well, because I do think about grief a lot and I write about grief, their families had no way. I mean, what a complicated way to grieve. They couldn't bury their body. They wouldn't have, you know, a tombstone or a grave to go and commemorate that. Even in terms of how they would think of them or remember, they would, such a stigma probably followed them forever. How traumatic for them who were left to mourn. That really struck me.
That's almost a horror we can't really comprehend, in that belief system of, if you're not buried in your faith in the churchyard, you won't go to heaven, you won't see God, you're banished forever, you won't reconnect with your family. all those sorts of things. That was a horror beyond the death that was awaiting women. They knew that if they were going to be executed as a witches and her family. And you're right, that is something that the family that were left, as you say, it's not just grief, it's a grief that's so much more complicated for them. And when I was reading your book, what I was thinking of quite a lot, without spoiling anything, was the trauma of loss and also intergenerational trauma, the fact how that echoes through the centuries and what people will do when they love people and they lose them. That was a very, very powerful driver in a number of the main characters doing things.
Yeah, I'm really glad that that comes through in The Lighthouse Witches, because, yeah, I think the more I thought about this, because research is a funny thing, isn't it? You begin with quite, what's the word, clinical almost data, the names and the dates and the places and what kind of facts you can gather around what happened. But as you, it's the sort of silences that you have to sort of work with and try and connect sometimes very disparate pieces of information. But when you, you know, for instance, when you see the same family name come up on the database and you recognize that it was relatives, it was likely mothers and daughters who were burned together, who were executed together. A large part of a family would be just devastated by this accusation. And it's the manner of the accusations as well. Sometimes it's the accused feels that they can maybe accuse someone else, or maybe it was, you know, someone coming in and saying, was so-and-so involved, and maybe they give the slightest nod or something that's taken as a affirmative answer. And this, you know, pattern and cycle of accusations just seems to have brought down so many different people, and it's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, I think you've done a good job of that. It does make you think about the connection. You know, there's one particular part of it where a mother is executed and who's going to look after her children? There's no state care at that point. You know, this idea about being just a child just being left and who's going to look after them and what's going to happen to them. I think you look into that really interestingly as well. It's a fantastic book, and I think our readers are definitely going to enjoy it. I think you've captured the setting so well, not only of Scotland, but of the island, and then also the lighthouse is so creepy. And I don't know why anybody would choose to go inside that lighthouse. As you're describing certain parts of it, which I'll not spoil, I was thinking, why would you do that? What are you doing? Bad things are happening if you go down that bit.
Because of loss.
Yeah, I'd be too scared. I don't think it would matter how much loss I'd suffered. I would be like, don't go over to that bit.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. Yeah, I love the sort of paradox of lighthouses, that I think they're very romantic symbols, but they can also be very creepy.
They're for keeping people safe. That is exactly the strange thing about it.
Yeah. There are these beacons, aren't they, that steer the ships and warn and protect, and they're hopeful, but they can also be very creepy. So I wanted to use that as this sort of, I think a setting is very important in a novel, to bring together all the different sort of themes and the ideas of the book can be rooted in that setting.
You definitely struck it there. I mean, the remoteness, the kind of loneliness, the spookiness, forest, it's all there.
Yeah. Good. So The Lighthouse Witches is out now by CJ Cook. You can find it in all good bookshops, I'm sure, and online in various places. It's been really great talking to you, Carolyn. Thanks for giving up
your time
to speak to us about your book. It's been ace. And we look forward to seeing what you come up with next.
Yeah, I was going to say, now that you've delved into the world of Scottish history and witch trials, is there going to be any more?
Well, yeah, I'm finishing next year's novel today, hopefully. Well, a first draft, should I say, and it's set in Scotland, and this one is set in the 1960s in a mother and baby home. So I am interested again in looking at women's lives, that little corner of women's history. Again, when I started reading about that, I was like, wait, what?
Another terrible, terrible history for another podcast.
Yes, yeah. Hopefully.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. And please do look out for Carolyn. You're active on Twitter, I think, aren't you?
Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And I have a website, just cjcookauthor.com.
And we'll put up links as well for people too. But definitely worth going and having a look at what else Carolyn has written too. So thanks so much.
Thanks for speaking to us, Carolyn.
Thank you.
thanks so much for joining us. Please, as ever, talk to us on the social media areas. The one where we're actually going to be able to chat to you is on Twitter. And we really do say, please get in touch, because we've met loads of really great people on there. We've got a Facebook page. That's not really an interactive one. We just use that to give people information. But we've also got, what else we've got, Claire? Instagram,
which is really, really busy. And as much as you hate it, Zoe, we've got TikTok.
Have you actually made some TikToks?
I've made the one TikTok in Orkney.
And is it a very popular TikTok?
It isn't. Well, no, not compared to the like 1.9 million where I think we have about 600 views. So
what you need to do is do something like braid a chihuahua's hair or something at the same time. You know, you need an angle, Claire, and I don't really feel you're exploiting TikTok properly.
I think you're probably right, and I'll bring Redford along the next time. He's a Jack Russell, but he's small enough to be a chihuahua, and I'll try and maybe braid his hair. I keep forgetting as well, do you know, we've got YouTube. We've got like thousands of views on YouTube because it's got the beautiful poem from Len Penny, and it's also got our International Women's Day event last year. And in fact, what we're going to do soon is we're going to stick up all the podcasts on YouTube so people can hear on YouTube as well.
Not with our faces. You don't mean like the...
Good God, no.
Right, because just for your benefit, listeners, Claire and I record these as Zooms. And, you know, Claire always looks beautiful. But I would say that sometimes I turn up for a recording, maybe not looking my best. And I really, really wouldn't want you to have to see that. That would be listener abuse.
What we're trying to do is encourage people to listen to us.
Oh, yeah.
And they will not be doing that if they were looking at us recording very early in a Saturday morning.
Yeah. That would be
no.
Far from ideal. Far from ideal. So we've got just a wee rundown. So we've got YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, is that it?
I think that's us so far.
Okay, so we've got all those different bits going on. But like I say, the best place to have a chat with us is on Twitter. And we're always keen to talk to people. So please do get in touch. We've got listeners that are in touch with us from all over the world. It's really nice, actually. Yeah.
Somebody the other day tagged us in something and said, I'm listening to you in South Carolina. And it was just so weird that you put these podcasts out and you don't actually think about somebody sitting down so far away and listening to her.
I wish I was there just now. COVID notwithstanding, that'd be nice to go somewhere, wouldn't it?
To go anywhere, Zoe.
Aye, oh well. Okay, until next time, adieu.
Adieu to you and you and you.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.